Welcome to the fourth session of our ModCrypt course, which we begin again with a short summary of what we have seen so far. In the very first lecture, we've seen an introduction and parts of the first introduction was looking at constructions like TLS 1.3 or the double ratchet and identifying that there are building blocks. Different building blocks that we use to come up with larger constructions like protocols like TLS 1.3, double ratchet, and so on. And the first two building blocks that we looked at rather informally was hash functions and key derivation functions. And then we started to develop a formalism. And the formalism that we use in this lecture is game-based definitions of security. As an alternative, we have seen that there are simulation-based definitions of security, which we won't use in this course. And we look very particularly at encryption, symmetric encryption, to see how game-based definitions look like concretely. And the two flavors of security definitions for encryption were, on the one hand, one-way security and indistinguishability, and on the other hand, chosen plaintext attacks and chosen ciphertext attacks. So chosen plaintext attacks and chosen ciphertext attacks refer to the strength that the adversary has in attacking a security goal, and one-way security and indistinguishability refer to the actual security goal that is trying to be attacked. And today, we look at more building blocks, but on a more formal level that is based on these game-based definitions. And on the very fundamental level, the weakest form of cryptographic building blocks that we typically consider is one-way functions. And one-way functions basically have the property that one can't invert them. So if you get the output of a one-way function, it's hard to get the input. The first layer of then real complexity comes with pseudorandom generators. It's pretty obvious how to build a pseudorandom generator, how to build a one-way function from a pseudorandom generator. Every pseudorandom generator is a one-way function, and the proof of that is pretty easy. The other way around is, however, very complex. And we won't cover this in this lecture. If you want to take a look at that, you can take a look at the book. But I think even in the book, it's not entirely covered how to build pseudorandom generators from one-way functions. Yes. Yes. So the construction of pseudorandom generators from one-way functions is by Hostad et al., and we won't cover that further in this lecture. The next step of complexity is then pseudorandom functions. Building pseudorandom generators from pseudorandom functions will be the task, the final task in your current exercise. And the construction of pseudorandom functions from pseudorandom generators is the so-called GGM construction, Goldreich, Goldwasser, Mikali. And we will cover that later today in the lecture.
What's written here?
Pseudorandom function and pseudorandom generator.
Okay.
Exercise.
Exercise and
Hostad.
That's
et al. That's the academic term for others.
That's Hostad.
Hostad, yes. H-A-S-T-A-D, where the first A is a Danish A with a circle on top of it.
And here is the GGM.
GGM, exactly. Goldreich, Goldwasser mit Kali. And the final step of complexity that is very directly related to all of that is pseudorandom permutations. The implication from pseudorandom permutations to pseudorandom functions is direct. Building pseudorandom permutations from pseudorandom functions, one can use a Feistel network. And we will cover Feistel networks in this lecture as well. So if you look at this ladder of complexity, you may think that I'm just making up interesting terms to just, I don't know, speak about generators, functions, permutations, but they're actually useful. So, pseudorandom functions can directly be used to build stream ciphers. Pseudorandom permutations can be used to build block ciphers. And pseudorandom permutations can also be used to build compression functions. For Merkle-Damgaard and sponge constructions that we have seen for hash functions. Yes, please. Compression. So if you want to compress something, then this is about compression function. So pseudorandom permutations are obviously useful. Pseudorandom functions are also useful. And all of them, especially pseudorandom functions and pseudorandom generators, are used for different purposes of key derivation. So we have seen that when we looked at the double ratchet, that there are scenarios in which we just want to produce from a smaller key two larger keys. This is what we can do with pseudorandom generators. And if we want to produce a large number of output keys, not only from one single non-adaptive input, then pseudorandom functions are the tool that we want to use. Yes.
What's the written compression functions for
Merkle-Damgaard and sponge constructions? Okay, so this is basically the roadmap for this lecture and next lecture, depending on how far we are, how quick we are, and understanding how they relate to each other, and of course, smaller building blocks or weaker building blocks can be built more efficiently, typically, and more complex ideas, more complex concepts can be built, typically, with more overhead. So it makes sense to understand how the smaller building blocks work and how to build the larger building blocks. One final addition that I wanted to make after last week's lecture is that we have seen the five steps to game-based definitions: syntax, correctness, adversarial capabilities, adversarial goal, trivial attacks. We exercised that with symmetric encryption. We came up with a game. We identified trivial attacks. And we defined the so-called advantage. We've seen that in the exercise today already, that defining the advantage is basically the last step that we do in order to define what security means for us. So it is necessary for someone who wants to use our constructions to look at the concrete advantage terms that we came up with, and when they are small, then they can be happy. But one can go one step further, and this is defining something about negligible and polynomial, as it is done in the Katz-Lindell book. And I basically copy this part here, so you don't need to write it down yourself again. And for completeness, I just wanted to add what polynomial and negligible means. So, polynomial and negligible. So, function f is negligible if for every polynomial p, there is a capital N, such that for all lowercase n larger than capital N, it holds that f of n is less than 1 over p of n. And that's basically the reason why these type of definitions with negligible and polynomial are called, just had it in my head, it's gone again, asymptotic, because in the definition of negligible, it's just necessary that for every polynomial there is one capital N. And this capital N can basically be arbitrary. The only guarantee that we want to have from this N is that after that n, 1 over this polynomial is larger than the function that we're considering. So we basically want that the probability of winning, of breaking our game, of breaking the advantage here, of breaking the game, should at some point be so small that it is smaller than 1 over a polynomial, and actually for every polynomial. Yes, please.
You need absolute values on the f of n.
I don't think so.
Or do you assume that it's a negative?
So what I want is that everything, so what I want is that at some point things are smaller than 1 over every polynomial. And if it is small, then everything is fine. But probabilities are typically not, so I'm talking about at the end about probabilities, and probabilities of negative things that typically don't make sense. Yeah.
They are not negative.
Yeah. Okay, so this was just the addition that I wanted to make. We won't use this. But it's established in cryptography, and if you want to see the discussion about it again, I recommend watching this invited talk by Mihir Bellari from PKC this year that I mentioned at the end of last lecture. Okay, and now we start with pseudorandom generators. Most of these parts have been discussed extensively in the lecture today, so I won't go into the very deep details anymore right now, in the exercise today, yeah. So a pseudorandom generator takes as input an input key and produces a larger output key. So this basically means that we generate more key material. And the syntax is that PRG G takes as input the set of input keys, or an element from the set of input keys, and outputs an element from the set of output keys. And we have a security definition that in the form of our boxes looks as follows. It is called IND for indistinguishability. It is indexed with PRG for the pseudorandom generator that we are analyzing. And it is also indexed with the challenge bit B, which is either 0 or 1. And it starts with first sampling an element from the input key space. Then it produces an output key. By invoking the pseudorandom generator on input of that input key. And then it also samples a random output key. And on the right side, we have our black box adversary. And we give our adversary either the first or the second output key. And the adversary has to guess which of the two keys they saw. Now, this is the boxes notation that we have seen in the exercise today. There is an alternative notation for specifying these games. And this is basically in pseudocode. So we have a game, and we call this game IND, as I said before. It's again indexed by the pseudorandom generator that we're looking at. It is also indexed by the challenge bit. And the input of this game is the adversary. Now the game starts. This is basically a copy-paste thing from this box to this pseudocode. But this is not meaningless, because there will be definitions of security that are so complex to write down in this boxes notation that it's much easier to understand those definitions in pseudocode. And we actually have seen one example of that already. So the one-way CCA security definition last week, that was super complicated. There were super many arrows, super many oracles, so encryption, decryption, challenge, again, encryption, decryption, and finalization. And this can make things complicated. And for that reason, this pseudocode-based specification can be easier to handle. So the game starts with sampling an input key. It also samples, it also sets the initial output key to the bot symbol or the bottom symbol. Then it executes the attacker. And it stops with the output of the attacker. Now we give the adversary the Oracle challenge. And this Oracle requires that the output key has not been specified yet. So the output key is still this bottom symbol. If this is not the case, the Oracle will just abort and do nothing. But if this output key has not been specified yet, we will set the first output key, OK0, to the pseudorandom generator output on input of the input key. And we will sample a random output key, OK1, and we return the output key OKB. As I said, throughout the lecture, we will see this is useful. And finally, we define the advantage. As the absolute value of the probability that the IND game on input or parameterized by the pseudorandom generator that we consider and the challenge bit set to 0 for our adversary outputs 1 minus the same probability only that the input challenge bit or the parameter challenge bit is set to 1. And as I said, intuitively, this means that guessing the correct bit B is similarly hard or likely for EB equals 0 and B equals 1. Okay. So this is our definition of pseudorandom generators. What are they useful for? So we have seen we can build other things from them. But we can also directly use them. So a typical application is that we have that the input key is half as long as the output key, or put differently, the output key is twice as long as the input key. And in such cases, We can use it, for example, in the double ratchet. To derive on input of a chain key an updated chain key and a message key. So we just produce more output keys. So how can we build pseudorandom generators? The first very simple form of building pseudorandom generators is from something more complex, which is pseudorandom functions. And as I said, this is the last task of your exercise. You can also build it from stream ciphers. And you can look up what stream ciphers are and how to use them to build pseudorandom generators in the PAR book on pages 38 and following, and in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 208 and following. And this is not a tautology. So for pseudorandom functions, it's pretty pointless. It's just an interesting exercise, but also not really. And also from stream ciphers. The idea is there are stream ciphers and pseudorandom functions that are not based on pseudorandom generators. And there are actually stream ciphers for which we don't use underlying building blocks to build them, but rather there are cryptanalysts that thought about these stream ciphers very, very long, and they didn't come up with good attacks. So if you have a stream cipher for which you think that it is good and that it is very efficient, and you didn't use a pseudorandom function to build that stream cipher, then it can actually be useful to use that stream cipher to build a pseudorandom generator. So only because things are maybe slightly higher in the complexity ladder of building something, or they seem to be more powerful, doesn't mean that those building blocks are not useful for building simpler primitives like pseudorandom generators. Okay, and the last very fundamental way of building pseudorandom generators are from one-way functions. Generically, and as I mentioned at the beginning of this slot today, this has been done by Hostad et al. At the SIAM Journal of Computation. In 1999. Generically, yes. From one-way function, generically, and this is Hostad et al. At SIAM Journal of Computation in 1999. Okay. Now, another repetition from the exercise today, but I think this is not problematic because it just repeats concepts. Follow the same counting scheme. So this is 1A. So we talk about increasing the expansion factor of pseudorandom generators. So given a pseudorandom function, G prime, with ik plus 1, where the length of ik plus 1 equals the length of ok, we want to build a pseudorandom generator G with an arbitrary expansion factor n. And the construction is pretty simple. It takes as input the input key, it sets the output key at the beginning to the empty string, which we denote by epsilon. And then, with a simple for loop, we collect output keys, OK prime, by using the underlying building block G prime, so the underlying pseudorandom generator on input of the input key. And the output is then passed and split into ik and x, where x is a simple bit. This bit x is then just concatenated to the output key, and at the end we return the output key concatenated with the input key. We have seen the schematic idea of this construction, so we begin with the input key. We derive from that the first output key, from that first output key we again only use the first n bits, or the first bits except for the last one, feed that into the pseudorandom generator, and without using it, we just attach that x, carry it over to the next step, and we continue doing that. So this is the final output key, and this final output key has length of ik plus the length of n. Just to very briefly repeat the proof idea again, we use a so-called hybrid argument, and it's not problematic to repeat these terms because you will hear them over and over again in this lecture. The hybrid argument, which is basically the same as a proof by induction, and in this proof strategy we start with some I prime from 0 and go up to n minus 2, so, or we start by 1 and go to n minus 1. And in each step, we replace the ith computation of the underlying building block G prime with sampling a random output key. And by the security of the pseudorandom generator, we know that if one of those steps is detected, so if this is detected, in step I prime, we can use it to break the IND security for our underlying pseudorandom generator G prime. Okay, so we talked about this thing in the exercise broadly, but if there are any questions, please go ahead. The next step is pseudorandom functions. And the idea of a pseudorandom function is not only to use the pseudorandom generator once, so you just have one input key and you derive one output key from it, but you have one input key and can produce multiple output keys from the input key adaptively. So you start with one input key, and then you have some context information like some associated data, and you derive an output key for that associated data. Then you have some other associated data, and you derive another output key for that contextual associated data. And you can continue doing that with more associated data to get more output keys. So think of it as follows: a function takes as input some x and output some y, and a pseudorandom function is a keyed function that outputs some y such that y looks random if the input key is random. More concretely, the syntax of a pseudorandom function. Is that it takes an input key and some associated data and produces an output key. Or alternative, we can just say it takes some key and it takes some element from a set X and it produces an element from the output space Why? A relevant extension that we don't cover, I think, I'm not sure, extension, that we do not really cover here, is that we have so-called dual or multi-key pseudorandom function. Dual or multi-key. Pseudorandom functions, and the idea is that f can take multiple keys as input. So up to n keys. As well as some element x. And it outputs some y. And you can take a look at this in a paper by Buckendahl et al. From Crypto 22. So after defining security for pseudorandom generators with that pseudocode, it's very easy to extend this definition for pseudorandom functions. Again, we start with a gain that is called IND for pseudorandom functions, and it takes as input, as usual, a challenge bit B and the adversary. And I leave one line blank. And I sample an input key. Then I execute the adversary, who outputs a guess bit prime. And the game eventually stops with that guess. Now, as for pseudorandom generators, we again have an oracle that takes as input values x. And it first produces y0 using the pseudorandom function on input of the key and x. And our goal for this game is that we want to model that the output of a pseudorandom function, or basically a pseudorandom function, just x as a random function. The pseudo comes from the fact that this input key k leads to the security not being achievable in a perfect sense. So we basically want to have a random function that is indexed by some k, and the idea is that if this function tree behaves as if all the keys or all the outputs that are produced by it look as if they were output by a randomly sampled function, then it offers the security guarantees that we want to have. And the way that we model sampling a random function is by initiating some array Q And then Q on input of X, if that has not been defined before, which is initially the case, then we sample a random element from the output space and assign it to that Q of X. So the adversary either sees the real output of the pseudorandom function, or it sees the output of that simulation of a real random function. So a real random output. The important part here is just that this is a function, so it always needs to output the same output on the same input. That's the reason why we have this array. So the definition of the advantage is just the same as we've done it for pseudorandom generators, only that we now define it for pseudorandom functions. So the advantage of that for the indistinguishability game for a pseudorandom function is the absolute value of the probability that the IND game for the pseudorandom function with bit b equals 0 on input of the adversary outputs 1 minus the same probability, only with a different challenge bit. So, all of this was very dry and not super exciting. But now comes something that is more interesting. So, makes sense now to wake up, not stop only writing down things that I draw on the board, and thinking about what I mean by that. So, first of all, we just remember pseudorandom function. Basically a function that behaves like a random function. So we can execute that pseudorandom function multiple times on multiple input x and derive multiple outputs y, and all these outputs y should look random if the key is random and not known to an attacker. In contrast, our pseudorandom generator only is executable once, because there is, besides the input key, no other input that we can produce or that we can provide to that pseudorandom generator. Now the question is, how can we build such a pseudorandom function? And the answer is given by Goldreich, Goldwasser, and Mikali. GGM. At Foundations of Computer Science in 1984. So, as I said, the idea of this construction is to build a pseudorandom function from a pseudorandom generator. which means again that given a pseudorandom generator G with the length of the input key is half of the length of the output key, or put differently, the output key is doubled from the input key, or the output length is doubled, which means that we basically have G of IK is some output key OK, and we call this output key OK0 and OK1. Where the input key length and the length of the two components of the output key have the same length, and we can basically call GB of IK the output key B, and what we want to build, as I said, is build PRF F. Yes, please.
I'm sorry, what's the word in the second line? First word in the second line.
Where? Where IK, so the length of IK and the two components of OK have the same length, and we just call the pseudorandom generator, or we specify that the pseudorandom generator consists of two sub algorithms, G1 and G0, and G1 of IK outputs OK0 and OK1 and OK0. Yeah?
On the first line currently visible, the advantage of the adversary equals absolute value of the probability of something minus the same thing, where is the difference?
The upper parameter is changes from 0 to 1. So in IND.
Can you close up
this
a bit?
So this is 0. And this is 1. Yes. Okay. Now we want to build that pseudorandom function from a pseudorandom generator. For this, we basically say that G of IK equals G0 of IK concatenated with G1 of IK. This is just a specification. So this is just what we specified here. We specify that our algorithm can be split into two sub-algorithms, G0 and G1. Where G0 outputs the first half of the output key and G1 outputs the second half of the output key. Now we start with the input key. And from the input key, we compute the two outputs, G0 of IK and G1 of IK. From that, we can compute again G0 of G0 of IK and g1 of g0 of ik. On the right side, we can compute g0 of g1 of ik and g1 of g1 of ik. Now what we just say, and this is the way we name it, we say that f of ik 0, 0 is the same as g0 of g0 of ik. For the second leaf at the moment here, we can just say f of ik of 0, 1 is defined as this cascade of executions of the pseudorandom generator. Can do the same for the two right branches. And we can actually continue that. For any number of input bits of the second parameter x here. So very concretely, our pseudorandom function on input key ik and input x is defined as g of xn g of x2 of g of x1 of ik. For the length of x being n. Or just put into words, what we do here is a nested execution or nested executions of the pseudorandom generator in the length of input value x. So GGM is super important. It's a construction that comes up over and over again. It's relevant to Merkle trees. It's one can extend, or one can think, or one, if you understand the idea, you can reuse this idea in very many different other types of applications. And just to repeat the idea, the only tool that we have is a pseudorandom generator at the moment for building this. And the property of the pseudorandom generator is, of course, the output of the pseudorandom generator looks random if the input is random. And the other property is that the output length can be split in half such that it equals the input length. Each of these components has the same input length. Now, if we want to build a pseudorandom function from that, the property that we want to have is that for every input key, we can take an arbitrary input value x, and we can produce from that, again, a random-looking output key. So from the pseudorandom generator that we can just invoke on single keys, we use this in a somewhat similar fashion as we used it for increasing the expansion factor. by executing a nested execution of these pseudo-NN generators. And we start with the first bit of the input value x. This first bit determines whether we go left in this tree or we go right in this tree. So let's assume we have an input value x that starts with 0. So we execute the pseudo-random generator on input of the input key and just take the first half of that input key, of the output key. And the output key is then again treated as the input key of the next level. So if our input string x starts with 0, 1, then we take the input key, execute the pseudo-random generator to derive the first half of the output key. This is the input key then again to the next execution where we just take the second half of the output key as the input key to the next execution and so on. So this basically gives us a pseudo-random function. Super dark in here. Now the proof idea, again a hybrid argument. So a trivial idea for proving security would be to use a hybrid argument that starts at the root, and goes down to all leaves of the tree, and step by step replaces real keys, real output keys, with random output keys. What's the problem of this proof strategy? So everybody wake up. This is not a super simple question, but one can come up with the idea. So our proof strategy hybrid argument would be, we start with the input key. We know that the pseudo-random generator gives us the guarantee that we can replace the output key with a random value. And one possible hybrid argument strategy would be, we start at the root and then go with some strategy through the entire tree and replace step by step the output keys. And then at the end, the entire tree consists of random strings. What is the problem of that that strategy? Yes, please.
The problem is the performance, because you have to iterate over 2 to the power of n iterations.
Exactly. So depending, of course, on what the size of the input values is, and so far we kept it generic, but we can think of this input space as something like 128 bit strings. This would mean that this tree here has 2 to the 128 nodes. And so we would need to replace 2 to the 128 nodes with random strings, which would basically mean that our reduction has a runtime of 2 to the 128. And if this is our proof strategy, then basically our reduction has the same runtime as just brute forcing the key. And so our reduction is as efficient as a very trivial attacker. So if our reduction comes up with a strategy of reducing an attacker against the pseudorandom function into an attacker that breaks the pseudorandom generator, in a runtime that takes as long as just attacking the pseudo-random generator without using any attacker on the right side, then our proof is pretty pointless. Okay, so we have to come up with a smarter proof strategy. And the idea is roughly as follows. So we start with a loop again for I in log of the size of the input space. So more concretely, if we have a pseudorandom function with the x values being 128 bit strings, then this loop runs for 128 steps. And then the second loop inside of this is, for each query, to Oracle challenge with input x. So a reminder, our proof has to simulate and extract with the oracles that we give the attacker. So we have this oracle challenge here. This is the oracle that our pseudorandom function attacker tries to use or can use. We perform the following two steps. First of all, replace computation of G in level I. Of the tree with sampling random output key unless this node was replaced by a query to the challenge oracle at step I before. Yes, please.
Increase the size of the text.
Yes. So I just read out again what I wrote here. For each I in the set of numbers from 1 to log of the size of the input, the input set x, we have one loop, and then the second loop goes from for each query to the oracle challenge, where x is the input to that challenge oracle. And then in that loop, we replace the computation of g in level I of the tree with sampling a random output key. We will see in the second visually what that means. There is one exception though. So if we did this replacement of the real output of G with a random key before, then we don't do this replacement again. So for the tree that we look at here, our proof strategy starts at the first level, goes down to the leaf level, so from the root to the leaf. So from I, for I, from 1 to leaf. This is the first hybrid argument. And then in each step, we consider all the challenges that in that step have nodes for which the output key has not been replaced by a random string yet. So there are challenges that are queried here, and if these challenge values need, in order to derive the output key, an output key on the path in the level I that has not been replaced with a random key yet, then we replace this random key in that step of in the outer loop I and in the inner loop for that challenge query. If this modification is detected, we can break the indistinguishability for the used pseudorandom generator G. This proof strategy is slightly more complicated, and since we haven't done it in very deep details in order to get everybody to understand it, it's maybe hard for you to digest it immediately. I think the only idea that you need to keep in your head is that we follow the same strategy, or we follow the strategy that we want to replace all output keys in the tree that are ever passed by a query to the challenge oracle. So if the attacker here at the beginning, here, if the attacker ever queries the challenge oracle, then internally we execute the pseudorandom function. And whenever we execute the pseudorandom function, then at the end of the entire hybrid argument, we want that all keys y0 are random strings, and also all strings that lead to these strings y0 are random strings. Because at the end, in order to come to an output y0, we always start with the initial level we execute. So if y0 starts with a 0, we go first left. Then if the second bit is 1, we go then right. And then we go left again if the next string is next bit is 0, and so on and so forth. And the result of that should be that we smartly observe what the attacker does by observing the challenge oracle queries. And we replace all visited nodes in that tree level by level via the outer hybrid argument step. So we go from the first level until the last level. And whenever there is in the current level that we execute a challenge that passes a node that has not been affected before, then we replace the output key of that node with a random string. And at the end, due to that, we have replaced all output keys and all the output keys on the path to these output keys with random strings, such that the adversary never saw a real output of the pseudorandom generator. Maybe think about that at home once more, but are there questions so far? Yes, please.
I have a question that's further up about the definition of security with the pseudorandom function.
Mm-hmm.
So we're the first line is we assign y0, pseudorandom function. Is this a random pseudorandom function? What are we exactly assigning there?
So, we analyze with this definition of security a pseudorandom function, and we will have to see whether it's a pseudorandom function or not. If it is, then we come up with a proof, or if we come up with an attack, it's certainly not a pseudorandom function. That's the reason why this pseudorandom function that we analyze here is the parameter to this game. Okay, so this is the algorithm, and this is the execution of that algorithm. And the execution of that algorithm takes a key and an X, and it outputs a string. And the intuitive property that we want to model here is that a pseudorandom function behaves as if we would just sample a random function such that whenever we input some value x, the output should look random unless we have evaluated the pseudonym function on that value before, because then it's just the same value as before. And this is what we do here in the second part. So we first execute the real pseudorandom function, get the output string, and then we check, have we seen this input before? If we haven't seen this input before, we just sample a random string from the output set. We assign it to Q of x, and we just assign Q of x to y1, and then we give the adversary either of those two outputs, either the right or the either the real or the random output. And the adversary has to decide which one it always saw, whether always the real outputs or always the random outputs. That's the property. Okay. Other questions? Yes, please. Yes. All of them are G's except for this line here, to make sure that you understand what the output of this pseudorandom function on input 0, 1 would look like if we would cut the tree at the second level. Yeah.
So in the proof, it's PR G of G, like the last line.
At the hybrid argument. This here is G.
Okay.
So we have an attacker against a pseudorandom function. The pseudorandom function tries to identify which keys are, or whether the keys that it sees are always real or always random. And then what we as the reduction do is step by step replace from the root to the leaf all output keys that are ever touched by the attacker. And by touching, I mean that when the adversary queries the challenge oracle on input x, then everything that is touched is basically something that for getting the output of the pseudorandom function on value x needs to be passed in the tree. And basically, for every input x, we need to go through one path of that tree. To get a rough idea of who, no, first the question, yeah. Typically, and yeah, only at the leaf of the tree, yes. So typically one would just say that all the elements of a pseudorandom function have the same length, which basically means that if you want to know what the pseudorandom function on input 0 is, then you would basically pad that to a fixed length string. And so the output would just always be at the leaf level, yes. And yeah. So this is a little bit irritating. So when I just have these dotted lines here at the bottom, this basically means that if the tree would be larger, so our input space is larger than 2 bits, then the fik of something would be much lower in the tree. OK. Yes, please. So this is a pseudorandom function, but the only thing that we need to have.
What is pseudo and what is random?
Okay.
If you want to create a truly random function, you need some physical effect because computational randomness is not feasible in general.
Yes. So the property that we want to have here is not that we produce randomness from something that is not random, but we always need some random input. So the input key always gives us randomness, and our guarantee that we want to have is that our function behaves as if it was a random function. And this randomness basically comes from the key.
Yeah, but
so
what does it help?
I mean,
it
helps.
You fill in some randomness.
Yeah. You must, yeah. You
drops down from
no, 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 no. Yeah. So if you remember the second session of the first lecture week, we had key derivation functions, and key derivation functions have the property that they can collect entropy from unstructured bad input and put that into short strings that look random. So you basically use these key derivation functions to produce your first random string. And once you have that, using pseudorandom functions, you can derive multiple random strings. Yeah. So let's look at that. Let's look at the second week.
How do you get to the point that we get a real randomness?
So when we talked about key derivation functions, we said that we have bad inputs that have sufficient entropy. Passwords might be a somewhat okay example, but there are other inputs that we can have, like machine randomness, I don't know, heat of the CPU or something like that, all of that. Accesses to, I don't know, to the memory. And the construction that I gave you, for which I didn't get into further details, is the so-called hash-based key derivation functions, which is HMAC-based, and this is a key derivation function. So if you want to derive initial randomness, then you would use this HMAC. But the problem of the HMAC is that we first need to understand many, many further other things. And for that reason, I just gave it to you and didn't go into the details here. What we now do today is that we fundamentally understand what is the relation between these fundamental building blocks. So those are building blocks that are relevant for understanding how to build very primitive concepts. And the most primitive concept that we know in cryptography are one-way functions. We don't build them. I just told them that we assume that they exist. The problem with one-way function is that we don't have a proof that any one-way function exists. We just hope that they exist, but there might be no one-way function. This is the most basic thing. And we have cryptanalysts that tell us, yeah, this might be a good one-way function, maybe this is a bad one-way function, we didn't find a good attack against it, whatever. So we are just in the middle, so we are just on a modular surface, and under us, below us, there are these cryptanalysts that tell us, good, bad. And now we build one step at a time, and HMACs are somewhere up over here. So if I really want to build a key derivation function, then I have to step up this ladder with good cryptography, with reduction-based proofs, and then at some point I have something with which I can derive this symmetric key that looks good from some unstructured randomness. At the moment, we started with one-way functions. I told you they can be used to build pseudorandom generators, but the way this is done is extremely complicated, so I left that out for you, and if you're super interested in complexity theory, you can take a look at that. The next step that we did now is using pseudorandom generators to build pseudorandom functions. Next step in the complexity ladder. And then another step in the complexity ladder is going to pseudorandom permutations. And for this, we use so-called Feistel networks. Feistel networks will be something that we look at next week. But before we look at that, we have to define what pseudorandom permutations are. But before I define what pseudorandom permutations are, first maybe other questions on the Goldreich-Goldwasser-Mikali construction. Okay, so who thinks that they got a rough idea of how this GGM construction works? Okay, this is sufficient for everybody to think about that at home until next week. And so the last part that we do now is defining pseudorandom permutations. So a pseudorandom permutation, again, takes some input key. Again, we can derive from that some output y1 via input x1 or y2 via input x2 or yn from input xn. And we follow this intuition that a function is something that takes an input x and produces some input output y. A pseudorandom function is a keyed function that outputs y, such that y looks random. And a pseudorandom permutation is a PRF where the mapping from x to y is bijective. Just a quick repetition what bijective means. An injective function is a function where every output has at most one preimage. A surjective function is a function where every output has at least one preimage. And a bijective function or a bijection every output value has exactly one preimage. The syntax of a pseudorandom function now is pseudorandom permutation has potentially two algorithms. Yes, please.
What have you written after the PRP, PRF? What is between the PRF and the...
With, I don't know. PRP is a pseudorandom function with x to y is bijective.
Okay, the
width wasn't clear. Yeah, sorry, w/.
Okay.
Yes. So the syntax is that our pseudorandom permutation possibly has two algorithms. The first algorithm is pi, and pi takes as input a key element and an element of set x and outputs some element y, where the input and the output say spaces are identical. And it potentially also has an inverse of pi, that it also takes as input key an element of set x and outputs an element of set x because x and y are identical. Now the last thing that we do is defining correctness. And for this we specify the probability that the PRP inverted with key k on the input of that pseudorandom permutation with the same k in some x outputs that x again. And this probability should be 1. For all k in the key space and all element x in the input space x. Questions? Yes, please.
Why do we use W in this?
Which one?
Y and don't use X instead.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a relation to what we defined before. Yeah, that pseudorandom functions have an input and an output space, but yeah, I could have just called it X. Yes, please.
I think a permutation is normally defined as between the a bijective function between the same input and output space. So technically, if you use a different output space, it would be just a bijective function. Just for the definition, because it isn't mentioned in the definition that it has to be the same space, right?
Yes. I didn't get the question yet, but yeah.
Yeah, that's not, it's something, I just wanted to add that to the topic.
Ah, okay, so that was a comment to the previous, yeah. Yeah. I see, yeah, I should have mentioned that also. Yeah. I think that's fine.
That means essentially that your bijectivity is only probabilistic bijective, not identical.
So since the probability here is, I'm not sure exactly where in which direction this question is going, but. Yeah.
You only do this with respect to probability.
Yes, but with probability 1.
Probability 1, but not exactly the identity. Like set theoretic.
So maybe we can discuss
it's
that.
It's not the true inverse function, it's just the probability wise inverse function.
But since the probability is 1, that should be the true inverse. Or maybe I don't.
Maybe the confusion stems from that the randomness is what how the permutation is defined. This is the random part, right? So the key gives us a random part that gives us the permutation, which is random. So the randomness is within the permutation, but the which values the permutation gives you once you plug in a value or you invert it, that isn't random. Do you understand what I mean?
Well, bijectiveness is on a mathematically on a set is just the identity function. Okay, now you have finite sets, so mapping a finite set to a finite set is either you have something that goes off or you don't.
Yeah.
So what you say is just the probability. What is there a difference to the true set theory identity?
I think for this I would need to look up your definition of true identity, because so if you have the thing is we want to have we require that pseudorandom permutations output the identity of the input for all keys and all possible inputs. And I'm not sure, so maybe this is just a different notation, but maybe so maybe we can take this offline because I think everybody else wants maybe to go. Oh. Yes.
If they are finite, then there is no difference between identity one by one
mm-hmm.
and probability.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you get one miss that's not identical,
yeah.
then your probability will be not.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the reason. Yeah. So I don't get the question then. This is, so I believe that, first of all, we define correctness in cryptography with probabilities. And I think that's something that you have to get used to. And other than that, I didn't get the difference yet. But maybe we can take this offline and discuss this longer such that everybody else can just go home. But thank you very much, everybody, for your good questions, probably. I need to understand your question first. And yeah, for your attention. See you next week. In 2 weeks.